14 April 1988, Oral History of Iran Program, Interview with Elizabeth Reed, Interviewer Mahnaz Afghani, Auckland, New Zealand. Elizabeth, thank you for agreeing to do the interview. Could you start with something about your background and where you were born and education?
Okay. Well, I was born in 1942 in Australia, in a country town called Taree. Both my parents were teachers, and I was the eldest of, as it turned out, eventually six children. I think the critical thing about, well, what are the important features of that? Firstly, on my father's side, we came of Irish stock. His father came over in the gold rush, and the story has it, landed in Melbourne, went to the local pub, met the publican's daughter, eloped, and went to the gold fields. On my mother's side, we were of Scottish and German ancestry, in fact. Her father's mother came from Scotland. She and her engineer husband and two children were to immigrate to Australia at the time of sailing ships. There was a six-month wait to get a passage on a boat. Her husband died, and she decided, despite that, to continue. She was an unskilled woman, she had no training at all, to continue with her children to Australia. So she came to Australia, she went to the gold fields, and she worked as a midwife. So that my mother's father began life as a miner, studied at night, and became a teacher. And I think on both sides were families of teachers. My father is the only person on either side who has a university degree. Although all four of the grandparents were teachers of one sort or another. And I think interestingly enough, despite the fact that I came in this background and that I was the eldest child as a woman, I always assumed that I would go on to university. And I did. I went on. I started studying economics and statistics and political science, etc. I moved eventually into philosophy and maths and logic. And so my first degree which I got from the Australian National University in Canberra, is an honours degree, first class honours in philosophy. I went from there on to Oxford, where I did a BPhil in philosophy. And in those days, life's different now, in those days a BPhil in philosophy was considered to be a more significant degree than a PhD. Mm-hmm. Basically, I'm trained as a philosopher. Mm-hmm.
And your first job was?
I returned to Australia after that, and in fact went into the university. Mm-hmm. I saw my life stretching out ahead of me as an academic. Mm-hmm. Went into the philosophy department and worked in the philosophy department. Now, I finished in Oxford in 70. Mm-hmm. And I went back to Australia mid-year and worked there, and at the end of 72, in Australia, we elected a Labour government, elected Gough Whitlam as Prime Minister, and this was the first time we had a Labour government for 23 years, so we had a long period of time with the Liberal Party, coalition, Liberal National Party in power. So there was a tremendous ferment it was a very exciting mm-hmm. period in Australian history. There was this feeling that it was time for a change, that there was a time for new principles to be manifest in the political arena, particularly principles of equity and fairness and things like this. Well, redistribution of income, all this sort of thing, protection for illness or accident, all this range of what was then called socialist No, Democratic Socialist probably platform. And as part of that ferment, at the same time, of course, the women's movement had come to Australia in 1969, problem there, plus or minus, for most of Australia, and had become a quite significant social movement in Australia, just in two, 3 years. A lot of the women had very good conceptual and analytical skills. They were beginning to analyse the situation of women and making strong demands for something that would improve these. So that in the early months, so indeed in the first couple of months of the Whitlam government, he decided that he needed on his staff somebody who could advise him about, somebody indeed from his background, who could advise him about the sort of policy issues that needed to be brought into the political arena relating to women. And it was never a tokenism. It was never a question of, oh, look, you know, we'll bring in the president of some traditional women's organisation. It was very strongly, we need somebody from this new social movement, which then was the Women's Liberation Movement. And we need that person in here advising us, what are we to do if we believe in a just and equitable world? What do we need to do to make sure that women are benefit equally also from this change, mm-hmm. Political change? And so I came in then, early in 73, I was appointed as his advisor. Now, this had never happened in the history of Australia. Mm-hmm. And indeed, in the world at that time, it was virtually unknown. The only possible role models would be the Swedes had had a commission on the equality of women, I think it was called, probably from the late 60s, I forget the exact date. Mm-hmm. And one had heard a bit about that. This was still, it was a commission, it wasn't mm-hmm. like a minister or an advisor to the mm-hmm. Prime Minister, but it was some predecessor. And indeed in India, they had also had a commission on women established prior to my appointment, going back to the turn into the 70s. But as a minister for women or an advisor to the Prime Minister, there have been certainly no precedent in Australia. And it was a move that divided Australia. Because I was taken from the Women's Liberation Movement. B, I was a philosopher. I believed in the search for the truth. I thought if people asked you questions, even if they were journalists, that you answered truthfully, you thought it through and answered the truth. We are on this long road searching for the truth. The sorts of things I believed in, I believed in strongly, and they came from that sort of primary concern for women. So of course the press had a heyday. Here it was, they would come along and ask me what I thought about rape or adultery or marijuana or all these abortion, all these highly contentious issues, and certainly, at least initially, I answered them. I told them exactly what the arguments for and against abortion were and where I stood on them or whatever else I thought about it. And so of course the headlines came out and distorted, so it wasn't just that position polarised Australia. Australia had been polarised over the position before anybody was appointed to it, but also my naive belief that the whole world was engaged upon a search for truth also contributed to the polarisation, because of course the views I held were not shared by lots. They were shared by lots, but not shared by lots of others. So it was contentious, so it was a highly visible position. I was constantly sought after by all the media. But beyond all that, it was an extraordinarily challenging time, because basically it was a clean slate. I mean, the question was, what do we need to do for women? And so you had to begin by working out what governments can and can't do, and then amongst what governments can do, what needs to be done first and how you go about getting it. And I mean, I've never worked in these arenas before. I was brought up in the cosseted and protected universe, academia. But it was very challenging, and there were, as I say, because the women's movement had, it brought together, it's interesting, I think the women's movement in each country changes depending upon those that it brings in at the start. And in Australia, in the start, we brought in particularly a lot of social historians. Mm-hmm. So women who were used to analysing the past, but the past from a particular perspective, which was the social history of the past, and we had a lot of skills that transferred knowledge of the past into assessments of the present or directions of the future. And I think that my job was made much easier because the movement itself had done a lot of the analysis. And my job really was to somehow bring together the analysis with the realities of political life and work out how you move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, did you have a lot of support from the government?
I had tremendous support from the Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. And that didn't flag until the end, and as soon as it flagged, I resigned. Mm-hmm. But it was the support of a principal person. He had never reflected on the role of women. But if you could put something in terms that he understood, in terms of his own set of values and beliefs, then it was fine. From the party itself, the Labour Party has its origins in the proletariat, in the people. In Australia, that means very much amongst the workers, and lots of the workers are Irish, and traditional views on these things. So that even in terms of the elected members of the Labour Party, the support was, to put it very mildly, very various.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some were as opposed to me as anybody in the community, and some thought, well, yes, these changes need bringing about. So that support was uneven. I mean, many of these people were attacking me as much as anybody else. Support from the women's movement. The women's movement was a bit divided. There were those in the women's movement that believed that one should take the revolutionary stand and stay outside these structures and just keep on reiterating what changes one needed. And others that believed that you had to go in to change the world. And obviously, I, to a certain extent, was in that last category. Those who were reluctant for the women's movement to be co-opted in this way felt that this process would in itself change the nature of the women's movement. Now, I think to a certain extent that's true. I mean, whatever would have happened, there was going to be money available for women's projects. There were going to be policies brought in which would bring about change. But there was a real ambivalence because some of the most significant changes for women didn't actually originate from governmental circles. They originated from the movement itself. So the first women's refuge ever in Australia was the direct result of the activities of the women in the Sydney Women's Liberation Movement. And these are the ones who before had been talking about reform versus revolution, but suddenly, as their analysis started seeing not only that women were battered and left homeless, etc., but that one needed direct action. One couldn't just sit there and describe it. One had to do it. One had to do something about changing it. So through their analysis, they moved into action, mm-hmm. into, if you like, straightforward reformism.
Mm-hmm.
And it was later that then the government moved in and mm-hmm. said, yes, of course we need these and they should be funded, and mm-hmm. off we go. So Australia now has this amazing network of women's refuges and women's services right across the face of Australia that subsequent Conservative governments have not been able to cut back or stop. But the support was there, and the support to a great extent wasn't. And I think probably these jobs, I mean, look, and let's not misunderstand, sexual harassment and sexism is rampant. Mm-hmm. It's as rampant in Parliament, as in Parliament houses, as it is anywhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. And the inability of men to work with strong and articulate women, unless they sexually subjugate them, and even then they normally can't work with them afterwards. But it was not easy. Mm-hmm. So I found it ultimately an extremely lonely and difficult there's some support. I certainly received support all the way through, but it thickened and faded. And what I felt most, I think, was that on the inside, I was learning about the realities of bureaucracies and policy formulation, development, implementation. And these realities do change your demands, because you begin to work out what can be implemented and how certain things can't be implemented. And what I lacked was what Bella has been calling a critical mass.
Mm-hmm.
I lacked any other women in significant positions, even in the bureaucracy, that could assist in that process of transforming demands mm-hmm. into reality, but B, who could and who knew what I was doing. So basically, there were the women who wanted change, but who were totally outside mm-hmm. of the processes within which I work, or nobody with mm-hmm. me. It was just me on the other side. So it was difficult for that reason. There were plenty of women who would support, but they just didn't. They weren't mm-hmm. inside.
Mm-hmm.
And now all that's changing as a direct result of these years.
Now, how long, all in all, were you in this position?
Hmm. Well, it was just going on 2.5 years. 2.5 years, I think.
And the International Women's Year came?
Yes. Now, see, so I went in early 73.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of 73, early 74, I did a trip around the world looking at social policy development in a number of other countries. And as part of that trip, I attended a meeting at the UN in New York. 74 was International Population Year. And in a very typical fashion, in that very long process that will result in a draft plan of action that will go to an international conference, suddenly, three, 4 months before the conference, it was discovered that women had not significantly been consulted in the process of drafting the plan of action. So they called a meeting of, 78 senior women in public office or governmental office from around the world to come and put some intake into that plan of action. Well, this was the first time I'd ever functioned in a political room, international political room. I found it very exhilarating, very fascinating, and very, very sort of depressing. I mean, it really was abysmal. All these men came in and spoke down at us and sort of really treated us like monkeys sort of swinging from trees or something. And we were powerless. I mean, everything was already printed. They didn't even tell us to. You know, 1/3 of the way, 2/3 of the way through the meeting, you suddenly discover it doesn't matter what you decide. You know, all their documents are already printed, ready to be shipped to Budapest or whatever the conference was. So it was very frustrating, but it was wonderful to be working in that international arena, learning about other women and their other concerns.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time I'd come across West African women. There were West African women there from small countries whose concern was population. I mean, they wanted to populate their countries, mm-hmm. not to cut back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so they were arguing against all the sort of contraceptive and family planning and spacing strategies. And at first you think, what's going on here? What are these women sort of arguing this way for? And then you sit down, I went across. I said, I don't understand. Tell me something.
Mm-hmm.
It was an extraordinary process. And so then 75 was the International Women's Year. And Australia, and again, it wasn't properly prepared at all.
Mm-hmm.
Australia, a consultative committee was called fairly belatedly in March, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And Australia was one of the Western European and other group countries that was represented on the consultative group. So I led the Australian delegation to that. Iran was, of course, on the group. And at the meeting, the consultative committee, Princess Ashraf was chosen president, and I was chosen one of the vice presidents. I can't remember who the other one was. And it was very interesting because immediately this very easy working relationship sprung up between the two delegations. These are very small delegations. It was just myself and a man and somebody from the mission in New York. But I remember speaking briefly with Princess Ashraf about this, and the plan that we worked out was that she would chair the plenary, but then that she would convene a working group as a whole. She felt probably I would get elected to chair that, and we would just push on doing all the work, and when we got consensus and everything, come back to plenary. So it was an excellent working relationship, and that's, I remember that most vividly from that meeting. Apart from the frustration of the content of the documents, that sort of thing. And of course, that's when we met during that period. So then, and you might remember, I mean, it was very traumatic times because it was the height of the NIEO, the introduction of the NIEO, and also particularly the Charter of Rights and Duties of States. And that the NIEO discussion had been introduced a couple of years earlier, but the in the General Assembly at the end of 1974, Mexico had introduced a Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States as part of the NIEO debate. And of course, Mexico was hosting the 1975 conference. And were very concerned to use that forum as yet another international forum to push ahead with their charter. And I remember there were some dramatic moments at that in the working group or subgroups of it as we tried to get agreement on the draft text, because I mean our concern was that whatever went into the text should reflect something, a concern for, or should point out the relevance to women of this. And of course, the male Mexican delegate. I mean, one could actually feel the guns on his hips, sort of stuff. I mean, you really felt this sort of this threat hanging over you. Certainly, I, as chairperson of the meeting, I was absolutely badgered. It was this terrible feeling. So, so we negotiated our way through that, and then we all then met again in Mexico City in June, July 1975 for the first conference, international conference on women, conference of international women's year. And again, it was interesting. Now, again, in that conference, I didn't want to take an office because I felt I wanted to be free to move. And again, I think it was can be said that of that Australia and Iran stood out as the active delegation. Our activity to a great extent was making speeches and rousing people to action and things like this, but out of that conference I think the initiative came from Iran for the decade, Iran for the International Institute, and Iran for the Regional Institute. Now, I mean, when we look back at the major achievements, there were a couple of major achievements, but to do with ideology, but perhaps the major achievement to do with initiatives were those three, that move into a decade, the international, and then setting up this network so that the UN system was itself starting to focus on women and their needs. So that was, I think, a very valuable conference. By the time I got back to Australia, politics in Australia were beginning to change. The Labor government was very much on the defensive. As part of our celebrations for International Women's Year, we had in August organised a nationwide conference on women and health, and in September a nationwide conference on women and politics. Again, this conference was meant to draw together women who were or wanted to be political active in whatever sphere, local government, trade unions, political parties of any sort or whatever, to give them the skills necessary to be able to be effective. And of course, you know, it started with total divisiveness. The Aboriginal women said we're underrepresented, the country women said we're underrepresented, you know, it was one of those extraordinary things. Now, by now, so what happened? The opening, by now the government felt its position was very delicate. Its supply bills, the budget bills, were being stopped in the upper house. It was running out of money to govern the country. the political scene was getting more and more ugly in many ways. So the opening of the Women in Politics Conference, because everybody came with all these expectations and tensions, was quite dramatic. The Prime Minister opened the conference. The Labour women, the women from his own party, demonstrated behind him as he was speaking with the television cameras focused on him against the decision he'd made about East Timor. Aboriginal women gathered outside and marched into the hall singing in the middle of his speech, and the radical lesbian feminists decided, because the invitations to all the women attending had gone out with dress suits, evening suits, yes, dress evening suits, they said. This is the Prime Minister's, the protocol department of the Prime Minister's department has been 23 years under a Liberal government. So the radical lesbian feminists decided they'd come in their evening suits, and so they came in their evening suits, and then they decided it was time to shake up Parliament House, so they raced around all the men's toilets and wrote lesbians lovely in lipstick and all those sorts of things all over the toilets. So of course the press had a field day. Monday morning, within the conferences, the tensions were still there all day Monday. It was this long, slow process of working through this conflict or these demands, changing to accommodate them, showing that they weren't based on reality or whatever it was. That process went on very slowly all that day and night. But of course the papers were bearing all these great captions showing all this disruption of Prime Minister's speech and the defacement of Parliament House and all this sort of thing. So at that stage the political advisers around the Prime Minister just moved in on him and said, you are losing votes by supporting women and you're losing votes by supporting her. Mm. You should kick her off your staff and you should draw back totally from any policies for women. Oh, well, kicking me off his staff, that was one thing. But by the end of the week, by the Tuesday, the conference was going beautifully. And by the end of the week, those women, they're still talking about it in Australia. It really was a very significant event for a whole lot of women. But by the end of the week, I had seen the Prime Minister. It became very clear to me that he had withdrawn his commitment. Mm-hmm. Not just to me, that you can deal with that by resigning or kicking up or letting some other woman into the position, mm-hmm. is the way you can deal with that. But to any policies, to pushing ahead with any of the policies that we instigated with respect to women. It was the wrong electoral decision. It's one that male political advisers often make, and it's wrong. They lose it. It's the same with the absolute in the States. They lose a lot of votes when they do renege publicly on these sorts of policies. So, by then it was just a matter of time. I just had to work out quite whether it was really an unrescuable position, which it was, and then how do I handle that? Well, I don't want to deny them the extraordinary changes that they have introduced for women, but I want to make it clear to the women of Australia that that time has now passed. So I issued a press release, I went underground so the journalists didn't hound me and distort what I had to say, and eventually went from the hub of the political arena in Australia to a log cabin in the wilds of Canada with the grizzly bears migrating south alone. So I sort of took a bit of a breath up there and wondered what on earth I was going to do in life. I mean, these dramatic changes that you don't expect and you certainly haven't planned for. And when you move out of a 7-day-a-week, 18-hour-a-day job, it's always under pressure and always working. It is difficult to try and bring your life back together again. Anyway, I then went on to New York, where I had some commitments. I had anyway some speeches to give and in the States around about this time, so I went on to New York. And it was while I was in New York, right towards in December then. Mm-hmm. So I got there at the end of October, November, December. The story as I heard it goes that Princess Ashraf, who was in New York for the General Assembly, heard that I had resigned, felt concerned that we got through that General Assembly, all those initiatives, all the significant resolutions, particularly the ones that Iran proposed in Mexico City, went through the General Assembly. So the question by then was, how do we make sure that the impetus of International Women's Year doesn't get lost?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the women who have been very active, surprisingly, a lot of the women who have been very active in Mexico City in 75 were no longer in the positions they held then. Mm-hmm. And I think what Ashraf wanted was, I mean, she herself was prepared, as she explained it to me, to remain a key front person, a spokesperson, an initiator, but she wanted to make sure that she was being fed the mm-hmm. right things from the international, to keep the international arena, to keep that pressure on mm-hmm. the UN, on its forums, its bureaucracy, all that, to keep it going so that all these initiatives were turned into reality. So at one stage she said to mm-hmm. somebody from the mission, Mehdi, I think, she said, well, wherever she is in the world, mm-hmm. find her, bring her here.
Mm-hmm.
And where it was dryly said, I think she's on the Upper West Side. So I came in. And so that was the start of a whole new life. Indeed, dramatic as well. Mm-hmm.
So tell us what happened when you went to Iran.
Right. I mean, I went to Iran to work on these international issues there. I think when I got there, of course, we met up.
Mm-hmm.
You as head of the Women's Organization, but also because we had this now, by now, fairly lengthy contact in the international arena. And I think it was almost, I think I got there right at the very end of 1975. Mm-hmm. And I think almost within a week, the announcement was made that you were appointed Minister of Safe Women's Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that was the timing of that period. So my focus of interest then was to get the International Institute off the ground, the ESCAP, Regional Research and Training Centre off the ground, and to continue on with ongoing bodies like the Commission on the Status of Women to make sure they didn't lose the vision and mm-hmm. the commitments and everything mm-hmm. being generated over 1975. So I think we started with the ESCAP Centre. As I recall, I'm not sure now of the ordering, but I either went straight back to, I'd only been a week or so in Iran when I went back to Bangkok.
Mm.
Did I go to Addis first or second?
I remember you were doing...
Yes, I think what happened was that there was an Iranian delegation mm. that was going to Bangkok to negotiate with ESCAP mm. on the... on the establishment of the centre for the Asian Pacific region. So I went as an advisor to that delegation. And that delegation negotiated. Were you on that?
No, it
was the ambassador there. But Khaled
probably.
Esfandiari, I think, went from Tehran with me. So that they, as being the delegation, negotiated with ESCAP and reached agreement with them. I was there only as an advisor. But having reached agreement, their concern was, again, that things get done quickly. So rather than leaving it to ESCAP to produce the draft of the project document and then send it back to Tehran and so on and so forth, they asked me if I would stay behind and write it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I did. I stayed on after that and produced a first draft. I worked with Bob Gasabekian
mm-hmm.
In ESCAP, and we produced I just wrote the first draft of the project document. Then I left that with ESCAP to do what they will and then transmit it formally back to Tehran. And I think roughly at that stage then, I went back to Tehran for a while, and then I went to Addis Ababa.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of that was Addis was the first regional, ECA, the first regional UN Commission centre that had been established for women. And I think you had previously been there to have a look at it. And so I went there to see what their institutional arrangements were, what work program they had adopted, why they'd adopted it, all those issues that come to mind when you're having to draft a project paper. So that was a very valuable exercise, but one in which I really did decide and came back and talked it over. I thought that things needed to be done differently in the Asian Pacific region, that the historical or other reasons for focusing, historical, economic or social reasons for focusing on particular things in Africa was not necessarily the way to tackle that issue in the Asian Pacific region. So that so then I was back in Tehran, and it was about this time, I mean this is a very active time, I think around about the same time, first of all, I think there was a delegation from New York, led by Razil Bazou, as I recall, who came to negotiate with you on the establishment of the International Centre. And again, I found in that case that they had very set ideas about how they wanted the International Centre to go. And that we, on our side, you and I, had very different ideas. And that was not easy. I mean, that whole process of negotiating that through, I mean, really, you could see the tension start right from that first delegation from New York coming to Iran. And then, of course, at the same time, there was the annual meeting of commissioners, or the biennial meeting of the Commission on the Status of Women being held. And Ashraf, for you.
You attended, I'm sure.
Yes. But there are a number of...
In Vienna.
Yes. I didn't go, I know, but my job was just to look at the papers and to start work on some of those things. So my entry into Iran, into Tehran in those ways was... I mean, you know, you got off the plane and started working, or got back on the plane again and went somewhere else to work. But of course, the cultural entry was really very different. I mean, this was what had I done? I had travelled fairly widely, I suppose, in third world as well as first world countries, but I certainly had never spent any time in an Islamic country, and I'd never spent. I mean, I've never spent that much time in a country where I didn't have the language and I couldn't read the script. I mean, and just to get around to survive, that all those were necessary. So it was a time of tremendous cultural dislocation. Yes, I'll say. It was terrible. Sometimes actually it was, I think I was in a hotel for a long time and in some ways that cushioned it, because I had this mental image of myself was being surrounded by a bubble, an airlock, and when I got into the hotel it would expand to fit the hotel and I would move around freely. But then if I was in a taxi going from the hotel, you know, it was in the Intercontinental, I think, down to Sassmonis Danon, to the women's organization of Iran, I'd feel this airlock sort of close all the way in around me. I couldn't read a sign, I couldn't speak, I couldn't communicate, I didn't know anything, I couldn't read any body language, nothing. Just nothing could I read. So this airlock would close all the way in. And then I'd get down to women's organisation, and then it would open in little pockets. I mean, because it always had to depend primarily on language. So your office would open up because we could speak in English, and some of the other offices that I began to meet, we could speak. But all the other, you know, all the other parts of the women's organisation were really sealed off from me by this airlock. And the only, at that stage, the only non-English speaking person. Farsi speaking person that got through to me was the tea man, who was obviously extremely concerned that here I was sitting in an office all by myself, absolutely unable to communicate with everybody, and so came in about, you know, 15 minute intervals to offer me tea, talking to me, you know, in Farsi, or not talking at all, but just looking as if to say, are you all right?
Did you get a chance to see much of the organization and the work it was doing?
Ah, yes. And that was really interesting also. I mean, at that time, we had informal contact, but obviously my role was not to do with Iran, per se. It was in the international level. But you and I had had a lot of contact and discussed things. And what was most fascinating to me was, first of all, as we sat and talked, it was clear to me that the analysis was very similar. I mean, I'd just come from a similar position in Australia, I ultimately functioned very much as if I were a minister in this. It was the way it was handled. The analysis was similar. It was very interesting. I mean, you look down what the problems will, the problems are, arise. There are certain things that women need in order to be able to enter the world. I mean, in order to be able to make any choices in the world. And that's going to include things like skills training, access to employment should they choose it, access to childcare, and a whole range of things. And that sort of analysis that we've gone through in Australia was very similar. I mean, you were doing exactly the same things with village women, not just urban women, but village women in Iran. But then, the example that really struck home to me at the time was childcare. Okay, sure. No, 74, we dramatically changed. We had a preschool policy before then in Australia. Then we brought in this new childcare policy, a multifaceted, multidimensional policy designed to assist women in their need, be it for occasional care or regular care or cleaning or long-term care or whatever, as well as to assist the child, be in an environment where it could develop properly and lovingly and warmly as a child. So that was a dramatic change. So what do we do? All right, yes, we've got our budget allocation, we've got our office of child care and all that sort of thing. But then the way on the whole we decided to go about it was by making money available to community-based groups who wanted to set up their own. What we did was we set up a family daycare network, so those women who wanted to after children in their own homes, we identified them, we paid them an agreed upon wage, we made sure that they were trained at minimally, but you know, hygiene was followed and all that sort of thing, and then we gave them support services. We gave them mobile toy libraries or women who would look after their children if they were sick, and we encouraged them to take the children along to the preschool so that all children had access to preschool, not just children of women at home. So that was one whole thing, and that was, if you like, where parents wanted their child to be on in a house with a woman. Now, where parents wanted their children in childcare settings, then primarily we did it in this community-based way. We made money available, we called for submissions, we were flooded with submissions, we checked them out and we funded them, and so local communities started establishing all this stuff. You know, I went to Iran, and there's the same problem, same analysis, but there was just no way that was the solution. Absolutely no way. There's a totally different community. It didn't, whatever the social or economic conditions that the sine qua non for that sort of community-based organization to spring into existence, or even, you know, setting up family-based care with a support system, this was out of the question in that country. So watching you go through from the analysis to the finding of the solution was an extraordinary experience for me, because I suddenly learned, you know, the non-transferability of solutions and the need, therefore, to find your solutions in the conditions that applied there where the problem was. And that's the exercise that you and the Women's Organization, well, as Minister and Women's Organization of Iran, were going through. So those years to me were very exciting, really, I think, in many ways. And I think also the other thing that I found very impressive was through the women's centres, that there was not this strict, I mean, they really responded in a multifaceted way without a strict demarcation. And that there was simultaneously a lot of concern about these women's lives, not just whether they could get jobs or whether you could train them in this or what have you, literacy or whatever, but particularly these problems of maltreatment, the ways in which women were physically or in other ways maltreated there. So that part of the work became counselling and support services, etc. And, you know, it's difficult to do, but that at least there was some attempt to do something about it. And there were enough success stories, I think, over the time that I was there, where particularly where you had cases of just extreme maltreatment of women, that the men were were brought to, were had to account. I mean, they, in, I don't know, in the local courts or where, I don't know,
yeah,
they used to
courts.
Happen to the family courts, that's
mm-hmm.
right, which were later abolished.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so there was this beginning of a field that the brutality to women could not be unlicensed.
Mm-hmm.
That it was limited, going to be limited, and that there would be retribution through the family courts for those. And that, I think, was also an extremely significant change. So, I mean, from where I sat, what I saw, I guess, was... Okay, and I think that the other thing that really impressed me over that period, I mean, this is, if you like, looking at the political and governmental processes, but there was an amazing strength in women. There was the pride and the strength. It's very difficult to perhaps capture well like this, but firstly, as I began to read back in the history of women, I was amazed that in that society, and I mean every day I saw manifestations of what that society was like in terms of how women were treated. But even in a setting like that, that there had been women who had been politically active since the last century and earlier, taking to the streets in their veils to protest politically against tobacco laws or whatever else it was. But then there had been an earlier move, but also then in the early 20s, I think, 1920s, so at some stage, no, 45, when was the lifting of the veil?
34.
Okay, so in 34, it was decided that that women should participate fully in the development of the country, and to do that they had to come out of their veils. And they did. And this gave them, I mean, in that culture, I mean, and what it means to go unveiled in that culture is really, I mean, to be harassed mm-hmm. sexually. But those women came out, and so that when I got there, there were women whose mothers had come out. So they would be the second generation of women that didn't wear mm-hmm. the veil. And that movement had been captured very beautifully in poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. What's the woman's? There's a woman who particularly.
It's a sunny.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I think yes. Mm-hmm. And that move out of the veils mm-hmm. onto the streets, into public spaces, mm-hmm. into offices and things like this, without a veil and with shoulders straightened back was an extraordinary. Now, obviously, this permeated only to a certain extent, but nevertheless that permeation was going further and further through the society, I felt, when I got there. And of course it is true that in Islam there are many ways in which women have rights that women outside of Islam don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And so under Islam women have the right to retain their name, the right to retain control over their own personal finances, etc., according to the Quran. And I think that also, given that in itself brings a certain independence, no matter what else is going on within the culture. So that I found a great strength in women, and it was good. I mean, just going and talking or watching in people's homes was always a very pleasurable thing. Now, I think during those years that I was there, this pride, I think that your appointment, the work of the women's organization, the role of both the Shah Banu and Princess Ashraf in pushing women forward in different spheres, in different ways, the focus on education, literacy, but education, girls in school and girls going through school, the economic changes that anyway were first forcing women out to work, began to snowball. I just felt there was this tremendous taking off, and so of course there was Damavand College, which is mm-hmm. a college to give women tertiary education, And there you could feel it. Going out there, you really could feel this sort of the feeling of change that these young girls felt, that the world was suddenly one which they could enter actively. And I guess I'm now moving us from early 76 through to late 77. It's not that long, is it? Late 77. Now, early January 78. I by now had a bit of the language, but I'm not of the culture. I don't have the language well. I am an alien. So I only see so much of what goes on. I don't fully understand. I didn't fully understand things. But January 78, it was the anniversary of lifting the veil. I had done some work at Dhanavand, and I was asked to go as one of the key speakers for that night for the ceremony, marking and honouring the lifting of the veil. And in a few days before that meeting, the most extraordinary thing happened. And basically, briefly, what happened was that the word, the directive came from key imams,
ayatollahs,
thank you, that no Iranian woman was to appear unveiled on that stage, on that night, to celebrate the lifting of the veil. And then there was this long to-ing and fro-ing about whether I was going to or not going to. And also the discussion about at what cost, if we disobeyed and we went ahead, what would happen? And all of a sudden you felt a fear of a violent retribution.
Mm-hmm.
And so at Dhanavand College that day we celebrated the lifting of the veil. I, of course, went unveiled and spoke about women and these changes, but all the Iranian women there were veiled and cowed, and it turned out afterwards were indeed severely attacked, because at one stage, I mean, these are women who had been out of the veil probably since birth. At one stage, one of the women had let her veil slip back. And so it was as if we hadn't worn those veils, if they hadn't cowered. So the response was quite strong and brutal. So they then got a lot of criticism. And that, for me, in retrospect, signals the start of the revolution. I think for whatever reasons, I don't know how it came about, but there just came a time when the religious decided to start exerting brutal force to stop this pace of change for women.
It's
amazing.
How would you relate then the revolutionary event? How close
back to that?
Help
me out. I think the next significant change was the there was a meeting that we were on board at that com, wasn't
there? Mm-hmm. Well, there was the uprising at home
that's right,
resulted in the student being shot.
Exactly.
But what I wanted to ask you was, did you feel during that period, and you were there until after the revolution?
Yes.
How much of the revolutionary events looked to you as if they were related to the role of women?
Good question. Okay. Seemed to me that there were. I think that, really interestingly enough, I do think that what stimulated the religious move then was what was happening to women. Women were just getting out of control, out of their control. And traditionally they'd control them through prayers and things like this, very much so. But women that they traditionally controlled were now demanding their rights. But at the same time, you had immense changes within the country. There'd been just a dramatic increase in rural urban migration. The south of Tehran had expanded almost visibly before one's eyes. It began to be the case that men could not marry, couldn't take a wife because they couldn't find a house to take one. food prices were doubling. I mean, each week almost they were going up, and people were beginning to talk. Oh, and the services were totally inadequate. I mean, hospitals, schools, all those basic services were totally inadequate, particularly in the south. And in that climate, then one began to have to buy access to those services. And people started complaining very bitterly about not being able to get their children to school unless they paid, not being able to get health care service in hospital unless they paid, and so on. So there was a very strong feeling of discontent in South Tehran. Now, this then, I think, became the instrument, the means by which the religious forced the revolution. And what I saw them doing, the way I saw it, was, now this, if you like, was not women specific. The women were there and the women were complaining, but that was men and women complaining legitimately about the results of a very fast pace of development that they culturally had not kept up with, that just governmentally had not been kept up with. So you had legitimate complaints. But what happened to those complaints was, as I saw it, was that each Friday in the mosque, the religious would, starting with those complaints, which were legitimate, about which people were angry, would whip up that anger, whip it up and up and up till it permeated that mosque, and then they turned it and they directed it against the Shah. Mm-hmm. And in directing it against the Shah, they had to accuse the Shah of something to justify that twisting, manipulating of legitimate anger to achieve their objective, which was to get the Shah out. One of the things they used was what had happened to women.
Mm-hmm.
So always, I mean, it was the Shah's policies on women, women in schools, so on and so forth. There were other things too. I mean, there was alcohol. Carter's visit came during this time. The Shah appeared on public television toasting Carter in alcohol. Disastrous, when the mullahs were whipping everything up to frenzy, so it's just something else. But I think then that why, one has to ask, why did they move then? Because Khomeini had been calling on this for this to happen for over a decade. Why then? And the answer to that is because there were just too many changes, and it wasn't urban-rural changes or anything like this. It was women moving out. And how? Well, there was discontent, legitimate, and it was whipped. It was whipped up, changed, and twisted, and directed against the Shah. And that's, people took the streets, and the burning and everything began. So, I mean, that's... And, of course, it became impossible to be a woman, mm-hmm. a foreign woman, a foreigner walking the streets, and of course I lived up north and I worked way down south, right near, just up from the bazaar, right next to Foreign Affairs. So over those months, after Black Friday particularly, I think, in fact, this is interesting because, now, all right, that's the macrocosm, but let me give you my microcosm, because I'm not sure that I ever spoke to you about it. I lived up north. I, in fact, was sharing the house of an Australian diplomat, another woman, so it was just the two of us in that house. Now, I think it was around the time of Black Friday, and I think that was about September.
Mm-hmm.
But everything had closed down. And we were up home, and of course a lot of my staff were women and non-Iranian women, and there actually were some visitors had come in, so it was a fairly tense time. So I had decided to have everybody up for a meal up to our house, and I did, and of course we had a meal and we were talking, and we decided to put some music on, and we decided we'd dance, and so we rolled up the carpets and we danced and we talked and we laughed and we interacted, and so that was fine. Now, and some guests stayed on overnight. They decided not to go through the streets, to stay on, so we got up the next morning and we sat up on the roof and had breakfast and, you know, drank juice, and then they went on home. And Robin went to the embassy, and that left me there. And I was sitting out on the roof, and I heard this commotion in the back streets. Eventually I understood the people gathering around our back gate, and they were effectively saying, and of course I was speaking Farsi, so what they said to me was I had to go and get my chador on and come down onto the street. And it was already, there was a lot of them, but it wasn't ugly, but it was worrying. All right, so I got my chador and I went out onto the street. And what it ensured was effectively a kangaroo court. Because we were two women living alone and men visited us, we were accused of being prostitutes. We were obviously not Muslim and therefore we were filth. And we had alcohol, parties, so on and so forth. Now, all this is going on faster, you have to remember. And the men are all around me and it's getting uglier and uglier. Women in the background, and they had tapes of Khomeini playing, mm-hmm. September. And they put me on trial, and I'm having to repeat what they're saying in my Farsi to try and make sure I was understanding. But to cut a long story short, they'd got nastier and nastier, and eventually they said, if I didn't either convert to Islam and come with them to the mosque 5 times a day. Or leave the country, by Muharram I would be murdered, I'd be dead. Now, and by the time they sort of gave the sentence stuff, everybody, the men, it was so ugly, it was so absolutely ugly, and I was surrounded, I couldn't get back to the house, there was of course nobody else around, and I didn't know how to get out, I feared for my life then. And the women were back in the second circle, and I had this chattel on, and I thought, I'm never, never, never going to get out of this. And so, eventually I tried to speak to the women, and tried to move towards the women, and eventually got through the men to the women, and they were still fairly ugly. But then my chador was not proper. Well, I didn't have all those proper skills, but anyway, I'd been under immense tension, and I wasn't that concerned that my chador was just perfect for the setting. So I got some of the women to fix it up, and that broke. That broke the ugliness, and then I held on to them and sort of forced them to walk with me to my back gate. That was September. So from then on, they would often gather outside and they would chant or they would kneel or they would do this or they would keep watch. They were there all the time keeping watch. So, and we lived up on the hill. So as that revolution progressed, this is a personal story now. You know, I'd be in my room at night and I'd have a balcony and I could walk out and the lights of Tehran were down there and the sky had the stars and this chant was just going up to the sky. And I'd lie in bed and I had a window at the back. Every time my curtain moved, I thought there was somebody there who was going to kill me. I mean, it was very tense. So that was all night. I got up very early in the morning. I had found out that our driver was one of Khomeini's troops, what they called. And because his cousin loved me, Mr. Javahiri, if you remember him. So the other guy who'd come in late to be the driver, he was training, he was one of the militia. And Mr. Javahiri warned me that his cousin had said that he felt if he'd killed 3 foreigners, he would be a martyr for the revolution. So, you know, 6 o'clock every morning, this guy turns up at my gate, and we pick up everybody on the way downtown, and you're sort of having these conversations, thinking, I've got to establish links with this man. I mean, I've got to do it for the safety of all of us at that centre. So you had this stress all the way downtown. We got downtown quite early, because you had to get down early. Then about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, then people would start moving up from the bazaar. They would surround that building as your staff. They'd surround that building, there'd be machine gun fire and things like this. But we'd just stay inside. But then by late afternoon, they would have swept right up through. And of course, all the banks, the furniture was emptied out, the kitchen was showered, the streets were burning, the people were whipped up by that stage. And every evening, we had to take all the staff off, and then I'd be the last one to be dropped. So you're driving through, and eventually you end up just, I had to wear a shawl, I had to keep my eyes down whenever we're in the middle of a crowd, because you're always in the middle of these crowds with rifles and fires and things like that, chanting and everything else. So you walk away all the way back up there, get back up alive to the house, and you get in the house, and I had this death threat all around me. I never knew when I get to see it out. I mean, that was just how. I think that was similar. If you were on the streets, of course, as a foreigner was
your role with the centre, you think, instrumental in the way you were treated, or just simply being
at home? I think at home, I think it was just that I was a woman living alone, a foreigner, so I was non-Muslim, and men came to my house, and they were rapidly conservative. They were calling all those directives about the role of women. So that's why it was. The revolution then at that stage just marched inexorably on. There was certainly no turning back at that stage. And so eventually, I would have liked to have moved the centre out of Iran earlier. I felt our lives were in jeopardy. But in the world of realpolitics, the UN was not prepared to move any of its projects out at that stage, because it would look as if it were making a political comment about the Shah. And so we were kept there. We were the southernmost UN project and the most vulnerable, because we were all women. We'd been directly associated with the Shah's family, with Ashraf. We were in his organization. So they were very tense times, and it was just very tragic seeing what was happening. And of course, part of what you're seeing was that what was happening to the women, and even those same women who were quoting poetry and talking about their future, very different future, those same women started going back to the veil. And eventually, Paris, Sofia Mohammadi, who was the deputy director, and myself, Paris would come, she would have been somewhere else, into an office or into a home or somewhere. All these women who formerly were so independent suddenly were appearing in veils. So we started a very informal project, but the aim was for Paris to talk to as many of these women as possible. Try to understand why they'd reverted to the veil. And something extraordinarily fascinating came out of that, and that is, in every case, almost without exception, every one of those women reported to Paris that she'd had a dream. And in that dream, she had been told to revert to the veil. And either the only variation on that theme was that in some cases the women dreamt of Khomeini, and it was Khomeini who told them to return to the veil. In other cases it was Allah. But in one or the other. And all these women, who often were university trained or certainly secondary schooling trained, independent, often working women, had all of a sudden, I had a dream, and now I wear the veil.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
It's a pleasure. I'm sorry it's been so rushed.
Thank you.